Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David James Gonzalez, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Roberto Lovato, author of Unforgetting, a memoir of family, migration, gangs, and revolution in the Americas, published by HarperCollins in 2020. Roberto Lovato is an educator, journalist, and writer based at the Writer's Grotto in San Francisco, California. As a co-founder of Dignidad Literaria, he helped build a movement advocating for equity and literary justice for the more than 60 million Latinx persons left off of bookshelves in the United States and out of the national dialogue. A recipient of a reporting grant from the Pulitzer Center, Lovato has reported on numerous issues, including violence, terrorism, the drug war, and the refugee crisis from Mexico, Venezuela, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, France, and the United States, among other countries. His work has been featured in several publications, including the Los Angeles Times, Der Spiegel, and many other national and international outlets. He is also a co-founder of the Central American Studies program at Cal State University, Northridge. Hello, Roberto, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Happy to be with you.
Great. Well, I'm super excited to discuss your wonderful memoir, and hoping we can begin today by just having you tell us, you know, a little bit about yourself personally and professionally.
Well, on a personal note, I'm the son of Maria Elena and Ramon Lovato, two immigrants from El Salvador, as you can read in the book. And I grew up with a father who was a janitor for United Airlines and a mother who was a maid with Hyatt Regency Hotels. We were a working class immigrant household. My brother and I, the only ones born here. And I grew up down the street from the projects here in San Francisco, and was an at-risk youth. Eventually got out of it and went to college and, you know, became aware of my Salvadoran identity, and ended up, you know, joining, you know, refugee populations, first here in San Francisco and then in El Salvador, and seeing the tragedies and the overcoming that I saw, I decided to do something a little more than just social service and join the opposition to the fascist military dictatorship backed by the U.S. government in the 1980s and 90s. And I was became an urban commando with the FMLN guerrillas. From there, I went on to, you know, as my bio says, join you know, Central American Studies and become a journalist. And now I'm here writing and talking about my book, and happy to be here.
Again, it's great to have you here. You know, the book and particularly the memoir in particular, I mean, as a genre to me is always fascinating. I mean, it's both about a personal journey, but also it speaks to a much larger experience and subjectivity, you know, for Salvadorans and Central Americans. Can you speak about, you know, how did you decide to write this book? Like, what was that process, you know, and that journey like for you?
Well, I'd always held this story in me for many years because, you know, as an activist, I've crossed over 30 years. I've crossed 2,500 miles and 30 years of war, genocide, gang violence, narco violence, government violence, and I've seen mass grave sites. I've been persecuted by death squads, Escuadrones de la Muerte, and, you know, there's a whole lot of sub-journeys in my journey. And I decided that I would finally tell my story after I saw a child in one of these immigrant prisons in South Texas in Carnes. A little boy named David and his mom. You know, and these prisons are just awful. You go to them and you'll meet, you know, boys who have scars on their necks from trying to hang themselves, and moms that have scars on their wrists from trying to slit their wrists, and those tender little voices telling you, quiero morirme. You know, those hard realities coming from those soft voices moved me to finally spill the beans of actually things I didn't even want to look at, because I was reluctant to look at El Salvador having absorbed so much violence in my life, and also, you know, absorb some violence in my home, which is difficult for many of us to talk about. I experienced violence, humiliation, and things in my house, along with love from my father. And I connect the secrets of my family to the secrets of El Salvador and the secrets of the United States, because it's a U.S. story, right? And I designed it as an underworld journey. And I discovered that I was an underworld creature whose father had, you know, my mom's living room and dad's living room had all kinds of pictures of my abuelitas, abuelos, tías, tíos, cousins, the cousin's dog, the cousin's dog's dog, and, you know, pictures of everybody in the living room, but only one picture of my father's family, Mama Té. And I was like, wow, I grew up with a family secret, but it was normal to have a family secret. I'm sure many listening know what I'm talking about, because we all have family secrets. And so, you know, I became Detective Columbo, wanted to understand this, and I then went to explore the secrets, you know, in the underworld, because it's an underworld journey into the criminal life in the mission here in San Francisco. With that, my dad was involved, and he used to run guns, and he used to run contraband to El Salvador. The underworld of immigrants that are in my family who are undocumented, and the underworld of immigrants generally that I've followed around the world, in fact, and especially across the northern part of the continent of America, and the underworld of the FMLN guerrillas, the underworlds of the gangs, the underworlds of El Salvador and the death squads, and the underworlds of the United States that funded all the violence and tragedy in El Salvador for almost 90 years. So once I decided to write it, I wrote it as an underworld journey, which is kind of, you know, it deploys what I would say mythopoetic sensibilities, because I think myth provides a shorthand for civilization to help us understand things in a very efficient way. So I felt like it worked, quite frankly, in the book. It worked for me, at least, to use the underworld, you know, structure, the underworld metaphor, you know, if you will, to tell a larger story about this epic of not so much of violence, but of overcoming, and what I call the tenderness that survives the terror.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned your experience in the detention center in Carnes City, Texas, and that's the first chapter of the book, right? Then there's the intro and the preface before it, but it's kind of one of the spaces where you begin with the book, right? And in that chapter, you start to talk about you're sharing with the mother and the son, right? And I think the social worker you're speaking to.
Well, she's an activist, right? More than a social worker.
Oh, there you go. Right, right. So you're right. So there's the activist. And then there's the mother and the son that are.
Yeah, David and Elena.
David and Elena.
And my friend is Ursula.
Ursula, there you go. Okay, great. And so while you're talking to them, you start discussing about where you're from, right? And you mm-hmm. mentioned where your father's from, Ahuachapan. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, Ahuachapan.
Ahuachapan, there we go, right? And you mentioned, you know, the aspect of, you know, silence that's tied to that place mm-hmm. and tied to, you know, your own family history, right? We speak about, you know, how that, you know, creates like a central theme of the book, how silence operates throughout the book. And the book itself is essentially, right, your effort to combat the silence, right? The aspect of unforgetting, recordar, right, is to, you know, combat this kind of central experience that's not only in your own personal experience, but you're tying this broadly to, right, the Salvadoran Central American experience.
Absolutely. You hit it, the nail on the head on that. When I wrote the book as a way to, as an act of what in America Latina they call, and we call, memoria histórica, historical memory, which is the use of memory to afflict the comforted, to pick out those things in memory, because anybody can remember. You can just remember as picking out a file out of a cabinet, right, in the cabinet of the mind. But to unforget is not just to pick a file, but to pick the right file that the rich and the powerful want us not to bring up. The rich and the powerful, the elites that want us to remain in ignorance about our past. Like, you want to cut enslaved people, indigenous people, colonized people. You want to cut them off from their warrior spirit, of their ancestors, of their tribal ancestors, of their indigenous heritage, and you want them to be allied to the nation state, to be good Americans, quote unquote, or good Mexicans, or in this case, good Salvadorans. So, you know, I came up with the title precisely because of that underworld journey, which unforgetting in Greek is a word called aletheia, which I studied when I was a right-wing, actually fascist, born-again Christian. So, you know, I was studying theology and I came across this word that in the Bible, the right-wing Christians were equating with truth. And some liberation theologians also equate it with truth. But in its Greek sense, in its origins, it described the journey into the underworld after you died. So the dead would either go to Hades or Elysium. But before going there, the dead had to choose, had to go into the river of forgetting, the Lethe River. And so the dead had to forget who they were in life before they could proceed into Hades or Elysium. And so the word for unforgetting is aletheia, not river of forgetting. And so theorists of fascism in the 20th century, like Hannah Arendt, resurrected this Greek notion of aletheia, of unforgetting, to describe the necessity to excavate the memory that helps us understand that does away with the amnesia that fascism needs to exist, like we see in, I would argue, with Donald Trump, but also with Barack Obama, right? Because those kids I visited, right? Because, you know, when you're jailing, separating, and killing children, you're performing a fascist act, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. And sadly, the president that started us on the path to doing this to Honduran, Guatemalan, and Salvadoran children as young as 4 or 5 was Barack Obama. So, you know, but people like to forget that because they want to have a good image, not just of Obama and Michelle Obama, but of the United States. But my job as a writer isn't to make you comfortable. It's to tell you what I know to be true and beautiful. Mm-hmm. So I caught on to unforgetting, and I was like, wow, that's a great concept to describe this journey I took across all these underworlds that were hidden, including the underworld of me being in the guerrillas that I'd hidden from myself and from others for 30 years. I was in the closet about having been an ex-guerrillero because I wanted to get a job as a journalist. I didn't think they would hire me. And so, and it turns out when we forget things, we often forget some of the best parts of ourselves, not just the painful stuff. And that happened to me with my journey as a rebel, which I associate with one of the best parts of me that, you know, is giving unto others beyond myself.
You know, you mentioned earlier, right, that we all kind of have like family secrets, right? Help us to understand, I mean, what is it like, right? So there's these silences that operate for all of us, both, I think, individually, like personally, right, and in our families. Mm-hmm. But help us understand how, you know, a state-sanctioned effort, right, to forget, to erase history, right, which is what your family specifically encountered, right, mm-hmm. that leads to the silences that you start to notice as a child, right, that leads you on this journey. Help us to understand that, right?
Absolutely. So let's take the example of somebody like my dad, grows up in Great Depression, El Salvador, that makes John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath look like a wine festival, right? So, you know, my dad grew up in the most absolute abject poverty imaginable in the Western Hemisphere, in the countryside and in the city of San Salvador. He grew up, his first job, like as a nine-year-old, was being the guy who was helping prostitutes' clients while the sex workers were with their clients. Because he grew up surrounded in all the units in his shantytown that he grew up in with my abuelita, Mamate. They were all sex workers, and they were my friends, my grandmother and my dad's friends. So my dad, unbeknownst to me throughout my life, had actually witnessed what scholars like a guy named Anders Sandberg at Oxford University told me is probably the single most violent episode, not just in Salvadoran history or Central American history or even Latin American history, but in world history, in terms of the numbers of people killed per day, per week, in a concentrated space and time. It's called La Matanza en El Salvador in 1932, something on the order of 10 to 20, 30, maybe 50,000 people were killed by their own government. The records of this slaughter were completely erased. You can, recent polls of Salvadorans show that 75% don't even know what happened. And so it's kind of like Salvadorans in this way are kind of like Jews in terms of being exposed to genocide and extreme violence. But unlike Jews in the United States, for example, there are no Holocaust museums for La Matanza. There are no textbooks to tell you about La Matanza. And there are no movies, like there's no Rodriguez's List, like Schindler's List, right? There's simply silence. And that silence carried forth in my father, who saw this, but never said anything for 75 years. So imagine a silence, 65 years, I'm sorry. Imagine the pain and suffering and terror of someone who can't say anything about something for 65 years.
Right, because your father was 9 years old when this happened.
Exactly.
It happened in his town.
In his town, yeah. One of the sites, one of the main sites was his hometown. So I, as an adult, as a young person, I didn't understand why I did, let me just be frank, the crazy shit that I did as a kid, whether it was joining a clique and robbing people, stealing cars, dealing drugs, and fighting a lot, or whether it was when I joined the urban commandos of the FMLN, I never knew why I did this stuff exactly. I just knew I wanted to do it, and I liked to do it. I mean, I didn't like it after you get exposed to the first taste of terror, but you know, you're a kid and you don't know any better. So I did these things never knowing it until I start realizing, like, hey, my dad kind of, I started teaching in Central American Studies and teaching about La Matanza and learning more about it and realizing, hey, man, my dad's hometown is like one of the major centers of this. He never said anything about this. So I approached him. I find a way to loosen him up. And sure enough, the piñata of my father gave up the candies of memory. And he ends up starting to cry along with giving up these candies of memory. He starts crying in ways I never saw him before. And we both started crying because he managed to cut loose from this silence he held in his heart. And I managed to realize, shit, this is why I was such a crazy dude as a kid. And why I'm still kind of crazy, to be frank. But, you know, but in a good way, I like to think. And so this is an example of the way that silences that are sanctioned by the state, whether it's the Salvadoran military dictatorship that began in 32 after La Matanza, or all the killing the dictatorship did from 1932 until 1989, when El Salvador became, with the help of the United States, the longest standing military dictatorship in America Latina. And so, or whether it's the silences that the United States doesn't you know, not only does Barack Obama, the one who starts caging, killing, and separating thousands of Central American children, but the United States has a whole history underneath, behind the eyeballs of the mother and the child that I visit. And that's kind of the story I'm telling, is there's such a far more deeper history than we're getting, that it needs to be told in a different way, which is why you have me telling my story as a memoir, which I never thought I would do. And then telling it in a way, as you, as those of you who that will read the book, telling it as what's known as a braided narrative, where I jump back and forth across time and space throughout the book. And so, I mean, if you look at that, that's also the kind of, when you write a memoir, you're kind of making a commentary on the nature of memory. And I'm trying to show the way that my commentary is that memory in its essence is fragmented, but it's especially fragmented when it's mediated by extreme violence. And violence causes what people call trauma. I don't like to overuse that word, because everybody and their grandmother seems to, you know, talk about their trauma, and it gets really disturbing how cheaply people use it sometimes. So, you know, the way that violence and erasure fragments our memory, and therefore fragments us from ourselves and from our history, is a big point of the book. I mean, it's not about the violence. It's more, like I said, it's about the tenderness that overcomes the terror, because in the tenderness is the vulnerability we need to actually remember who we actually are.
I appreciate you mentioning how, you know, your strategy here, the organization of the book, right? You phrase it a braided narrative, and I appreciate you using that phrase. It's a phrase I wasn't familiar with, not being a literary scholar, you know, in studying that. But it's something which I talked about with my students as we read your book recently, of, you know, how you are jumping back and forth between place and time, and, you know, you use your, I said you start in, you know, Karn City, Texas, as we already discussed, but then you go back in time, right? You go back in time to your father's childhood, and then you jump to your childhood. And it seems that the narrative follows, you know, your father's maturation from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, as well as yours, right? Those are like the time periods that you're jumping back and forth between, as well as, you know, the spaces are, you know, the town, the kind of migration journey that your father grows up in, as well as your own. Can you speak more about how, you know, that itself, you know, not just your own personal journey, but this is reflective. How is this more reflective of, again, I think the Salvadoran, right, and Central American experience? I mean, 'cause that was startling for me, you know, to see, I mean, the city that you grow up in, right, and the cities that you are connected to in this storyline, right, the Mission District of San Francisco, right, and,
L.A.,
LA, Pico Union, right, et cetera, mm-hmm. right? I mean, those are the epicenters of Salvadoran migration, right, in the United mm-hmm. States, and they remain so to this day. And also, I mean, that connection between, I mean, your father's own hometown, his journey, it's amazing to me how personal this is, but also, again, how this speaks to such a much larger subjectivity.
I mean, my real point, one of my main points in the book is how what we call the epic is always kind of like a bunch of casino chips of the intimate, right? I mean, the wealth of an epic, whether it's an epic love story or an epic story of violence, it's got to be made up of a bunch of intimate chips. I hate to use casino chips, but, you know, my family like to gamble. You know, I like that image of casino chips, you know, because it's the wealth of memory, of intimate memory, that makes up the epic story. And I didn't realize this was actually an epic story until after I'd written it. And I'd actually lived through this stuff. So like, wow, man, that was, people are saying, hey, man, that's a pretty epic journey you're on there. You know, 90 years of your family history, genocide, war, gang violence. And I just lived it. I didn't know I was kind of doing this epic thing. So I don't like to say it's my story and my family's story. And if it's taken on meanings for other Salvadorans, I mean, that is one of my intentions, for people to see themselves in some form. You know, those of us that are born here are children of Latin America, what Jose Martí called the continent of light, el continente de la luz. You know, those of us from here that are living here and are connected down there, you know, we have these issues of stuff we've inherited that is bordered off from us literally and culturally and legally and psychically, right? We're bordered off from the origins of our pain in many cases, especially when with the children or the grandchildren or great-grandchildren of migrants from America Latina. And any, whatever you're from, I mean, that's just a, I think it's kind of a common story where people migrate and they're cut off from things, including their the understanding that they can have as to why they feel things like what the poet Roque Dalton called medio muertos, half dead, mm-hmm. right? Because he said that we were all born half dead in 1932. And I didn't understand what that meant when I heard it. I didn't understand the poem, but I kind of liked that phrase because it felt real to me because I kind of felt half dead as a kid and I didn't know why. And I went out to do all this crazy stuff. And then as an adult, I come to realize, oh, wow, that's why. And so the book became a journey from being, say, half dead and ignorant to being more conscious and more fully alive as an adult now. And I would like to think that, you know, that would be something that not just Salvadorans or Central Americans, but anybody that reads. Because, you know, I consciously wrote this as, quite frankly, as a blueprint for apocalyptic times, how to navigate apocalyptic times. I've been in war. I've covered extreme violence among gangs. I've gone to, you know, 2,500 miles. I've been, you know, I've had to deal with narco killers, gang killers, death squad operatives, mass grave sites, and all the horrific things you can imagine that war and all and gang violence and other violence bring. I've been exposed to it. And I, you know, like I said, later on, I realized, God, it was an epic. So I did write it with a mind to like say, all right, here's the Jedi knowledge of what I know about apocalypse. Because people that study like what the literature of the of what we call the apocalyptic literature of the Jewish tradition that became a Christian tradition, right? The apocalypse. Some of the people like Anathea Poitier Young, who I actually talked to, a theologian, told me that she had to study two countries to understand the conditions under which the apocalyptic literature was written. One of them was Argentina. The other one was, take a guess, El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, God damn, I know more about apocalypse than I realize. And so I'm like, okay, well, I gotta, my mission in the book is to drop as much whatever wisdom comes from, I hate to ascribe wisdom to violence, but if you survive it, you do get, and you manage to become a healthy person anyway, then you've got some wisdom. And we're gonna need lots of wisdom to navigate this current moment of intersecting crisis that is nothing short of epic, right? And it's going to continue. We're going to continue in crisis for the foreseeable lifetimes. So I've written something that for me is a spiritual guide, kind of toad as toad through my life, of why I don't have a bullet in my head, for example. Because I've had the desire to take myself out in the past. I don't have that anymore. So how did I get there? How can that help others? It's kind of one of my big intentions in the book.
Yeah. You mentioned the phrase half dead, and that's something that comes up in the book several times. And I'm wondering, is that tied? When I kept reading that, I would think back to this experience you share, where you're sitting on like the front porch or step of your apartment, your home, right, in the Mission District in San Francisco with your father. And you drum up the courage, right, to ask him why there's essentially no pictures of his family on the wall except for his mother, right? And his response to you at that time is, and you're kind of like seeing this as a great moment for the two of you, and he just like coldly, almost like cold-heartedly, as you explain it in the book, turns to you and says, "We're never going to talk about this again. Like, you don't ever bring this up again." He didn't even answer the question, right? He just said, "We're not going there. We are never going to go there." And like this crushed you. I mean, so in referring to this experience of being half dead, is that tied to the not knowing that part of your family history? Is that, you know, where you're, bringing in that connection to what that felt like for you growing up, being half dead?
In the Salvadoran context, it has to do with like I've made a study of the families of like different survivors of genocide. Like when we created Central American Studies, I studied very closely, and I spoke with some frequency to some of the people that created Jewish studies at Northridge and other programs. Right, I wanted to understand the way that scholars took the experience of extreme violence, like genocide, and transformed and turned it into an intellectual pursuit, whether through political science, psychology, history, and arts, you know, literature, etc., like Primo Levi, you know, great writer, or you know, Italo Calvino, who another great writer. So, in trying to understand that half deadness refers to the feeling that we get as a result of the violence in El Salvador as survivors, as family that has an umbilical connection, as individuals that have an umbilical connection to genocide and extreme violence, even to this day, right? Like if you look at El Salvador, when I'm there in 2015, it's the very moment it becomes the most violent country on earth in terms of homicides, surpassed only by wartime Syria at the time. So, and you're talking like there's no war in El Salvador in 2015. It's the gang violence and the government violence. We often forget governments, by the way, when we talk about gang violence. So, I think half dead also can be applied to people in the United States. My U.S. side. My U.S. side was half dead because I had no idea. I was cut off from the truth that the United States funded genocide, mass murder, caging, separating, killing of Central American Salvadoran children for more than 90 years. And it's still doing it in different ways, and funding police that are murderers, funding militaries that are murderers. And this is just tiny little El Salvador. But then if you look at the scale of it, like across the Americas and across the world, you have Guatemala, you have Nicaragua, you know, Honduras, Colombia. Look at Mexico. Mexico that I knew growing up was not a carpet of mass graves that it's become. Thousands of mass graves, many of them dug and filled with dead bodies by their own Mexican government that's supported by the U.S., that began with George Bush, and that really accelerated under Barack Obama. But you didn't get that in your news. So Mexicans are going to start feeling half dead more and more, right? Because of the mass killing in Mexico, whether it's through narcos or government violence, you're still exposed to that feeling. And I would hope people can read my book and take some sense of what that feeling and identify it and the ways to overcome it. Because you have to go into the dark. You have to go into the pain to overcome what the pain is silently doing to you anyway. So when you try to when you ignore something like that, you make it stronger, right? When you repress it. It's like an iron rule of psychology. That which you resist gets stronger. So I kind of did a judo move on my pain and on my darkness, and I dived head first in writing this book. And one of the wisest things I did, because I wouldn't just recommend anybody just dive into your horror stories of your past, but do it carefully, do it smartly, do it de una manera preparada. You got to prepare. So one of the wisest things I did in writing the book was actually retaining a therapist before I embarked on the journey, because I knew I was going to open up the Pandora's box, not just of my violence that I witnessed and experienced in the mission here in San Francisco or in LA, or the violence of the war and or the violence of the gangs and all this violence that I've witnessed or experienced, but also the violence that I didn't even know I inherited. So retaining a therapist helped me map out the emotional terrain of my life that I was going to be telling in the story. And it really was one of the wiser things my dumb ass has done.
I appreciate you bringing that up, because it makes me, you know, want to hear you talk about what are the other things that you did to, you know, prepare to write this book? And who informed you? I mean, a lot of this is your personal journey, but, you know, there's a lot more than just personal knowledge here, right? I mean, you've mentioned that a lot of this, since so much of this history was, you know, kept from you and hidden from you, you know, who else did you speak with? Who else did you consult with, right, as you prepared to write this book?
I talked to all kinds of family members. I talked to neighbors. I talked to friends of family. I talked to people in El Salvador, in different places I went, people that were ex-guerrilla with me. And then I, you know, I expanded it to include journalists, historians, political scientists, novelists, poets, you know, scholars of Salvadoran life, but also scholars of U.S. policing. Because I make connections, as you know, in the book between, say, the kind of policing that Black Lives Matter is fighting and the policing and militarization of El Salvador, because the U.S. sent trainers to El Salvador to then, you know, to train death squads and military. And then where did those trainers go after the war? They went to San Francisco, L.A., New York, Portland to train police forces in counterinsurgency, which is where you start getting these police uniforms becoming these, from being these very thin uniforms to being RoboCop that we have today, right? With camouflage and heavy vehicles and, you know, semi-automatic weapons and grenades and all kinds of things designed for war brought into the inner city by pretty much every president since Ronald Reagan, right? As you had this militarization of police that went on, it got especially strong with Obama, who actually sent people like the Border Patrol to go train at a place called the School of the Americas, which was a training center for the worst mass murders in Latin American history, like Augusto Pinochet or the founder of the death squads in El Salvador, Roberto Dabuisson. So to come up with all these connections that I made, I had to interview ex-cops. I interviewed historians of policing in L.A. And other parts. I read a lot of books. I interviewed ex-military people. I researched, you know, I even went to West Point, you know, to do research. And I talked to like these really inflated egos of these military strategists who were cowards in uniform that, you know, helped, you know, train what right-wing fascists believe was a successful U.S. military engagement in El Salvador by training death squads to kill, you know, children, women, and elderly people in towns like El Mozote, where in December 1981, about 1,000 people were killed. Half of them were under 12. Half of those kids under 12 were under 6. And the leaders of that operation were trained at the School of the Americas. 10 of like 12 of them were trained at the School of the Americas. So I go into these archives to, you know, kind of research stuff that is not easy to find. I went to forensics labs in El Salvador where the bones of young children killed today by the gangs, right? Because a lot of the gangs are kids and killing each other, are next to the bones of children from El Mozote from 1981 that they're still excavating and trying to figure out what happened. So that's kind of the mass graves of El Salvador, the forensics labs of El Salvador, the layering of bones, literally, is the way to, we have to go into there, that darkness, to find out who's who, what bones belong to who, and, you know, who did what. And so we're barely solving some of the crimes against humanity of the war. And we're wondering why violence continues today. Well, you've forgotten, you have amnesia about mass murder and genocide. So, you know, I interview forensics specialists. I interview cops. You know, I interview death squad cops and death squad operatives. So I connect all these dots across, you know, it took me like 5 years, about a year and a half of research and then 3 years of writing to put it all together. And that's why there's like three dominant metaphors in my book. One is the machete, right? The machete, which cuts up our memory, right? It's a very common thing for Salvadorans to have a machete in a formerly agricultural society. And people, you know, my dad had them in the living room. And the machete is a perfect metaphor to cut up memory, like the way it's cut up by violence. And then the other metaphor is forensics, the way forensics literally takes the bones of our memory and pieces them back together so that the forensics labs can not just figure out the truth, but then give the bones, the completed bones of their loved ones to people who are whose lives have stopped because they don't know what happened to their son, their daughter, their mother, their father. And so when you give the bones to those victims, I've seen those entregas of bones. It's a tragic but beautiful thing at the same time because those families start to have some closure. So I make a parallel between the forensics work and my grandmother, Mama Tay, sewing. Because my grandmother would sew the disparate pieces of cloth to create dresses for women and men and boys whose lives were erased and hidden behind words like puta, prostitute, indio, Indian, which is a racist way to say indigenous person, or gang member, pandillero. You know, all these labels hide the humanity. And my grandmother would give people clothes that were tailored to their desires and kind of as a way, and I saw that as a way of giving humanity back in the same way that the forensics labs give humanity back from memories, people with memories that have been chopped up with a machete.
Yeah, that metaphor struck me right from the beginning. You know, you mentioned as the machete of memory. And then the other one you just mentioned, I mean, the layering of bones of, you know, the victims of state-sanctioned mass violence. I mean, in 1932, as you describe, and all the way into the Civil War, I mean, it's indigenous people, right? It's these are laborers that are working, right, on coffee, you know, essentially plantations, you know. So those are the victims, right? And these bones are all layered kind of in the same gravesite. But then you draw the connection to today, that those bones today that are on top of, right, the previous mass deaths are of youth, of young gang members, maras, right?
You skipped one, though. You skipped the bones of the 80,000, some of the 80,000 people killed in the 80s and 90s.
In the Civil War, right. Yes,
right.
Yes.
So,
right. And I mean, it's such a striking image you paint in the book when you realize that, you know, the forensic labs are excavating these graves that have bones from all these different periods. And the question I wanted to get to here, which was another key and surprising, for me at least, element in the book, in a very positive way, was, you know, your sincere effort to try to understand young Salvadoran gang members, right? Can you explain that, right? Because as you bring up in the front of the book, right, the beginning, and anybody that watches the news, right, if Salvador is mentioned, you know, it's shortly thereafter is followed by, you know, the words gangs and violence, right? And you take on this sincere journey, which is a key part of this book, to try to understand what drives these young people, right, into, you know, gangs.
Yeah,
so how is this all connected?
Well, the gangs are Salvadoreño. People would try to deny it. You know, something like 35% of the Salvadoran population supports exterminating the gangs as a way to solve, you know, the issues of violence in gangs. So, I mean, 35% of the population of El Salvador has some fascist inclinations, and quite frankly, because that's not how you solve these problems that are created from poverty and created by history. I mean, a gang member is nothing if not a walking, talking, sometimes shooting, gangbanging, walking trauma, right? Unresolved trauma. And so, you know, we have to get beyond these labels. And I knew that. Well, with even the label of refugee, those are actual human beings who have a history. You know, and what's the history we all have history, and what's the history that makes us? So the layering of those bones is one way to help people understand how deep the rabbit hole of violence, not just in El Salvador, but of the United States, right? Because remember, those bones include people killed by the military dictatorship from 1932 forward. They contain the bones, the boxes, literally boxes in this place called the Bone Room in the forensics lab. Have the boxes of people killed during the war, the boxes of young gang members killed today or in their victims. And these are the ones that are unclaimed, right? That are anonymous or unsolved, because there's so much they don't have enough resources to solve all these crimes. Like 90% of or more of homicides today don't go investigated. Most of the mass graves haven't been dug. So then you got the bones of those groups, and then you have the bones of the people that are found from El Salvador all the way to Texas, in a town that I went to, like Brooks County, where instead of having forensics labs deal with it, the justice of the peace in these little towns, you know, like Falfurrias in Texas, would just take the bones of women and children found, you know, in Texas and put them in plastic bags, not just the bones, but the remains, put them in plastic bags and milk cartons and dump them in mass graves that funeral parlors then manage for them and put up, say, anonymous on these plaques. The saddest thing you'll ever see. And so, I mean, I draw the line, the bones that run from 1930s El Salvador all the way to present day United States, Texas, Arizona. And those are the bones of our forgotten memory that we need not to forget if we're to rescue our humanity, not just as individuals or as families, but as countries. So like the story of El Salvador it's got genocide in it and it's got mass murder, but the Nazis in the story are not just the Salvadoran government. Unfortunately, the Nazis in this story were supported by the United States. The United States wasn't fighting Nazis in El Salvador. It was backing, giving them guns, protecting them, lying about them, training their death squads, etc. And so, you know, this idea, I mean, the good thing about Donald Trump is he exposes nakedly what the United States is in that way, that part of the United States. The fascistic part of the United States is clear in Donald Trump in ways that it's obfuscated and hidden under somebody like Obama, who will smile and si se puede you while continuing to cage, separate, kill Central American children and provide weapons to murderous governments of El Salvador, Mexico, etc.
I want to stay with the on us discussing, you know, the youth of El Salvador, mm-hmm. right, and you know the Maras, because I mean your challenge, right, for us to see the humanity in people, I think is if you can see the humanity in a gangbanger, right, that's an incredible obstacle for most people, whether people listening to this have an experience, right, of course, with El Salvador or not. I mean, we understand, you know, how gangs and gang members are represented in the United States, the type of policing practices that are enacted against them, right? And I was wondering if you could share with us kind of more of the eye-opening moments you had on your journey, right, in your reporting as you're, you know, traveling to El Salvador and you're meeting with, right, members of, you know, MS-13 and 18th Street, et cetera, both of which gangs, of course, come from the United States, right, as you describe and people, right? Mm-hmm. So tell us about give me an example or two of where in speaking with, you know, these, again, youth and, you know, some of them, of course, are adults, but that really opened your eyes, you know, to their humanity and this crisis of the gang sanctioned, you know, violence and mass murder against them. And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, right? That the, you know, their police death squads in El Salvador that go out and indiscriminately kill young people that they associate with being gangbangers, and they're throwing their bodies. Yeah, they're exterminating them and they're throwing them in these mass graves, right? So that's, I mean, that's the mindset of the police force. And you had to fight against, I mean, not just that Salvadoran context, you had to fight against, I mean, your own experience, you know, as, you know, a Salvadoran American kid growing up in an urban city, seeing the policing practices, seeing how youth are criminalized, seeing, you know, how the police departments have been militarized over time. So, again, share something about that with us, you know, that really opened my eyes.
I mean, the first kid I saw who was at risk and violent and robbing people, you know, beating people up, dealing drugs, getting into a lot of fights, had his father pull a gun on his chest. I mean, this kid named Tito. That's what they called him, the kid named Tito. That kid was me. So I didn't have to go far. We had a little clique. It wasn't like a hardcore gang like today. But we had our little clique. It was called Los Originales, and not very original name. But you know, we did all this stuff, not everything. Like, these kids now are really hardcore. We weren't as hardcore. We were just kind of loose-knit, but you're talking about in the 80s, in late 70s, 80s. So it was me. So then when I'm going around, and this part of my point in the book is I'm not just some white journalist with no organic connection to El Salvador, right? I'm Salvadoreño parents. I grew up in the city, working class, and I have a background in my own history, my own psychology.
And you had visited El Salvador plenty of times, right? Visiting family, right.
And I saw
up.
I saw the war. I saw what preceded the war, and I eventually became engaged in the war, and I saw the children of war. So I don't see this in the news reports from all these white journalists or any other journalists, really, hardly, because not that many have the experience that I have with relation to El Salvador. Right. So I'm like, I felt the burden of my experience and I wanted to share it. And so I take the reader on the journey first by going into my own heart of darkness, quote unquote, right, which is the kind of the frame, the colonial narrative that they give us. People like Joan Didion, right, who says terror is the given of the place. My point in my book is, yeah, there's terror. But, you know, you, Joan Didion, concluded that after fucking 2 weeks, mostly at the embassy of El Salvador. Of the United States. Imagine what I feel like in 57 years of this stuff, being connected to it from birth. So from 57 years of this, I concluded, yeah, there's terror, but there's also love. Love is also the given of the place and of the people. And that's kind of a big point of mine, like kind of paralleling the forensics and the sewing that my abuelita did, my writing, my journey, is to show that. And I do it in the case of gangs, for example, who are the primary symbol of Salvadorans in the world. So if we're going to rescue Salvadoran identity, however, we have to rescue the identity of gangs from the myths of monstrosity that they're given to them. So I go and I just do my thing. I show them they're not so different from me. They're not so different from you. They're not. I interviewed this gang member, Santiago, who's at the very top of the killing chain. He's like one of a handful of people in the world who speak for 70,000 gang members on both sides. He's like a gang diplomat. I go to his secret hideout and we talk, and he's got this book on a table. It's The Hunger Games. And it's like, you know, it's kind of like those kind of tan white ladies in, you know, near Cornelius Park in Berkeley, where I used to live. You know, they put up art books on the table so you start a conversation starter. So this top-level gang member puts The Hunger Games on there as a conversation starter, and I bought the bait. And he proceeds to show me that he knows about the Iliad and Homer, that he loves Romeo and Juliet and Shakespeare, that he's read Galeano, that he's read Gabriel Garcia Marquez, that he understands politics and strategy and negotiation with the Salvadoran government. A brilliant guy. And I ended up, you know, like, well, I show people, look, that's what happened to me. I was expecting to talk to him about the gang negotiations, the death squads pursuing them, the killing they do, why does a kid become a gang member. Ended up talking a lot about literature with this guy and showing, like, well, you know, he's not so different from me. And so he's not so different from you, reader, you know, except, you know, you dealt with your poverty if you had it in a different way. But like you, this killer loves literature. And you can't deny that. He's smart. You know, he's a killer, but he's smart. And he's got a complex identity, just like we all do. And so, like, you know, I also just indirectly want to show how useless these ideas of good and evil that Christianity or Judaism or all these other religions give us. They're not very useful, these infantile ideas of good and evil that you see in Marvel Comics, for example. You know, good guys are blonde and, you know, exert violence against bad guys that are darker that exert violence, right? That's such an old trope. It's dead. We have to kill that trope, right, to save our humanity from these simplistic ideas. So that's kind of what I want to show in the case of Salvadoreños. It's not just, like I say, it's not just about Salvadoreños. It's also about the United States. You know, this idea of a city on a hill, America the Great, you know, America, this shining city on a hill that shines forth human rights to the world. Well, you know, El Salvador shows that is complete and unadulterated, and I hope your censors don't get us for this bullshit. Okay.
Right.
So
and you were exposed to this rather young, right? As a on one of your trips, your home to or to your parents and mom's home in El Salvador. I can't remember. Was this taking place in San Salvador or not? But I think you're speaking with a cousin or a family friend in El Salvador, right? And I think you're around 12 or so, and you start engaging in this conversation about that's going towards politics. Your family members kind of like criticizing, I think, the current government. And then they basically kind of tell you to butt out, like, what do you know as an American, right? Kind of attributing you with the violence of the U.S. nation state, right? I mean, so I bring this up to say that, I mean, you had a very personal and quite early kind of experience of having a family member in another country, right, while you're in that space, view you as part of that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up like any other kid, calling myself American. I go to see the San Francisco Giants when Willie Mays was playing. You know, I would pledge allegiance to the flag and cry sometimes, whether in class or sing the Star Spangled Banner at the Giants games with my dad, or play with G.I. Joe and other military toys, and stand up for the U.S. Army that was doing righteous good in the world. And Jesus was righteous too. So this is the world that I inhabited as a child, watching the Brady Bunch along with Chespirito and other, you know, Bullwinkle and Rocky. My friends called me Mr. Peabody because I had thick glasses and I was very bookish as a child before I rebelled and said, screw all this. And so, you know, I was a good American. I beat this guy in chess who was a university student when I was like about 11 or 12. I was a really good chess player, a chess champion, actually. So he got pissed off and he started, you know, then he starts talking about, you know, how tu país es lo más mierda que hay en este mundo. Your country is the biggest piece of shit in this world. And I said, what do you know about America? So I defended him with all the righteousness of G.I. Joe, Thor, and Marvel Comics and Jesus gave me. Because I was American, and prior to that, everybody else in the neighborhood and everybody looked at me like I was walking on air because I was American, quote unquote, right? Because that's the kind of the colonial condition that is set up for us to visit as people from the United States with the privilege of, with the privilege and the decadence of U.S. citizenship. So then the book is basically the story of how I became American. I was American, and then I kind of started waking up to what the United States was doing in El Salvador. I'm like, holy shit, they're bombing, killing children. I visited and saw things I won't repeat right now because I don't want to trigger people, but let us say that they are among the most ignoble things there are to see on earth that I saw in places like Chalatenango during the war that were done to children and mothers and grandmothers and grandfathers, abuelas, abuelos, niños. By the hundreds, by the thousands, 80,000 people were killed. The United Nations produced a report that 85% of those people were killed by their own U.S.-backed government. So when I come to awaken to this...
And they were predominantly indigenous, right? They were probably
mostly
working class.
They were mostly campesinos, indigenous people, right? You know, poor people, poor urban workers. I mean, the death squads did...
People that were being labeled as comunistas, right?
Comunistas, whether they were nuns, priests like Monsignor Romero, the best known, whose murder has still not been solved. So imagine all the anonymous people who've been killed who have no investigation of the crimes against their humanity. So, I start realizing, damn, man, being American is not that cool after all. And I decide not just to join the FMLN guerrillas to combat the fascist dictatorship backed by my country, the United States. But I also make the decision to stop using a term to refer to myself, American, unless it has an accent around the E, on the E, or unless it's in comillas, in quotes. Because America, if you look back, even in the history of the United States in the early 18th century, in the colonial era, even people in the gringos talked about America as the Americas. Only later did people start stealing the term to refer to the country. And so I want to rescue that tradition of recognizing the continent of light that I talked about, the continent of light that Jose Marti talks about, because larger than the Salvadoran story for me is to show kind of the poet warriorship that we're going to need to navigate apocalyptic times, and that we of that are descended of the peoples of the Americas, Black, Indigenous, you know, Brown, Asian, you know, we're a very mixed group, even, you know, the whites of America, some of us, working peoples, we are going to play a role in history that's unique. We are, I believe, those of us who are descended of the Americas in the United States, the northern front, the northern tip of the insurgent continent of America. In order to deal with climate change, which is a quote-unquote American development, right? Because American-style capitalism is what brought climate change. It wasn't the Soviet Union. It was, you know, U.S.-style capitalism as applied by the entire world, including China, to destroy the planet, basically, and the life-sustaining systems of the planet. So that's kind of the bigger thing for me, is to reflect back to we ourselves, that we are part, and we're the northern front of this insurgent continent of America, that we have a history of visionary insurgency, of intrepid, powerful. And I mean powerful when you're talking about overcoming the things that not just my people, but that our people in the Americas have overcome. They've overcome America without the accent. That's how badass our people are. And I want people to remember that and unforget it, so that we can take on the necessary struggles that are going to dismantle the sources of climate change, of migrant destruction, of exploitation, of sexism, racism, and all the different manifestations of U.S. empire. Because the fate of the world depends on whether or not we're able to dismantle U.S. empire at this point. And that's why I decided to come out as a former urban commando with the guerrillas. It was a difficult decision for me to unforget that publicly. Because I, you know, what if they don't give me a job anymore? They think I'm too radical. What if, you know, hey, can you get tenure with being an ex-guerrilla? I don't know any, but maybe. Right? You know, all these questions that the system puts you before you. But I finally said, screw that. I got to tell my truth. And this is the moment to share it in history right now, where people need something like I like to say, we're not going to liberal progressive our way out of climate change or any other, the massive crises we're facing. We're going to need something stronger, which for me meant kind of the poet warrior tradition, where the distinction between poetry and politics, between revolution and rhythm, was indistinguishable.
You know, that leads me directly to essentially where I wanted us to wrap up and close this, which, I mean, I can't help but read a book like this and or even imagine someone listening to our conversation and then getting the book and reading it, right? Then, you know, and seeing this as a call to action, as you've already been essentially doing, you know, in your last comment. But for those listening or those readers that read your book and then try to think, you know, I mean, say they're whether they're Hispanic or Latino, or whether they're Black or Indigenous, or whatever they may be, right? They want to do something, right? What can they do?
Well, if I could answer that, man, I'd have better book deals than what I get. I got a good deal on my book, but, you know, but seriously, what can we do is the question of the moment. I could just speak from my own example. You know what, I've tried to do things my entire adult life. I helped refugees communities in the United States and in El Salvador and Guatemala and other countries. I've reported on things as journalists. I've taken up arms to fight fascists, dangerous, murderous, mass murdering fascists. I put my life on the line. I don't want people to do that. I don't want young people to do that. I want people to avoid that. But we're going to have to do things to confront, things that confront the murderous neoliberal capitalism that is literally destroying the life-sustaining systems of the planet. So if you go to El Salvador, underneath all that violence is the destruction of the water systems, the drying of the land, the destruction of the crop cycles that makes things more tense, that creates more violence. Same thing in Juarez, where I visited. Same thing in the border with Turkey and Syria that I visited. So I think first thing, we got to educate ourselves, become conscious of the real enemy of the planet, which, you know, Evo Morales and all these indigenous people that I met in Bolivia said, you know, it's big capitalism that's destroying the planet. That's a threatening Pachamama, right? Mother Earth. And I think the degree to which we're clear about that, then we can take a, we don't have to take on the whole monster. We can just take on our little piece. And you can defeat the monster by, you know, starting your own local power structure, whether it's to kick out liquor stores and put in something else, or to create your community garden, or create an escuelita where you're developing and studying together, mm-hmm. history, ideology, fascism. We have to understand fascism right now, because there's a new kind of digital fascism that is afoot. But you know, so we have to raise our consciousness and then take action. I mean, my own theater of battle right now is the theater of the imagination. I think behind all these crises is the crisis of imagination that doesn't allow us to embrace emancipatory, like liberation thought. We are trapped in many ways by ideologies of enslavement of the mind, right? And you see it in schools, you see it in online and video, you see it in your families. I mean, I have to be the bad news for some of my students sometimes, but you know, those of you that have evangelical parents that are love Donald Trump, your parents are kind of sympathizing with fascism, I hate to tell you, but their interpretation of the Bible is fascistic, right? I mean, you know, as if Jesus would support Donald Trump. Okay, well, yeah, that's really cool there. Good luck with that. You know, so you know, to have a, I mean, you know, this generation has its work cut out for it, as do the ones that follow it. And, yeah, you know, I the last thing I would say, I think, go visionary and go hard. Go visionary and go really hard, because nothing short of that is going to help us really confront the disasters that created by the amnesia and the forgetting of who we were. So remember who you are, go visionary, and go hard.
Bueno. Well, gracias, Roberto. Thank you for your time. Thank you for this book. Thank you for coming on New Books on Latino Studies and sharing this with us, sharing your truth with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, man. Thank you, David.